Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime for interesting conversation. And we also encore at 6 p.m. on Friday evenings in case you miss it on Tuesdays. Real Talk is the show I like to think of as the one that pursues answers to questions large and small. Today, I've got a big one. How did we lose our human soul? And you might be surprised to know there is an expert who has something to say about that. He is Michael Mead. Welcome, Michael.
Good to see you, Susan.
Michael is the founder of Mosaic Multicultural Foundation, and you did this 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You've been in the mythology business for 30 years.
More than 30 years in mythology. 30 years ago was the beginning of trying to apply mythology to community building and community healing.
Ah. What made you think about that?
I think it was the realization of how rough things were getting and how many people were left out of the beneficial aspects of life and how many young people were losing the sense that their life had meaning. I was kind of onto that before it became so darn popular.
I was going to say, you're describing today.
Yeah.
So before we get into Awakening the Soul, which is your latest book, I want you to tell us a little bit more about Mosaic, how it started 30 years ago, which you just told us. Where is it now? How did it get here?
Well, it started with working with at-risk youth and communities at risk. I just got the feeling I was old enough to try and give back somehow. And what made sense to me to help was to help young people struggling to find a sense of meaning in their life and a way to aim their life at something valuable. And so I just started doing it. And yeah, and then we built a nonprofit to do that. And now it has two sides to it. One is the idea of community work, awakening the soul of individuals in order to rebuild the soul of community. And the other side of it is publishing, in which we do podcasts and recordings and books.
And your podcasts are weekly?
Podcast comes out every week.
And people can get those how?
Mosaicvoices.org. There's a free podcast every week. Currently, that's going out to 110 countries.
That's incredible.
We call it Living Myth, and it's one of the few avenues for using myth as a valuable source in dealing with modern issues.
And there are plenty of those to deal with. How heavy is that responsibility for you to essentially reassure people once a week?
Well, it never seemed that heavy because I love the telling stories and working on the stories that are happening in the world and happening in our culture. But recently it's felt like a heavier responsibility because we get so many emails from people saying, I wait for this every week in order to have a better understanding of the world or in order to feel like there's hope in the world. And so I must say, I do feel that as a weighty thing.
How do you maintain your own sense of hope?
Well, I lose it on occasion, although I actually think there's something deeper than hope. I wrote an essay once on the second layer of hope. The first layer of hope is like genuine, simple hope. We hope for the best, and it never turns out that way. And so there's a deeper kind of hope that you find after you've lost hope. When you've lost the innocent hope, you find deeper levels of hope, which part of which I think is imagination, that underneath enduring hope is imagination. And so the two things I'm always suggesting are missing in contemporary culture are a loss of soul and a lack of imagination. And so I think the deeper sense of hope for an individual life or for cultural healing or for the world comes from a greater imagination of what life is and life's capacity, whether it's in nature or in culture, to renew itself. And so I think we're living through a time of collapse and renewal. And everybody can see the collapse by now, I assume. A lot of people don't know the renewal is happening at the same time.
So how do you, in your book, Awakening the Soul, which folks is now available on at mosaicvoices.org.
Amazon.
And Amazon. Okay. Yeah. Where you can find everything you need in the world.
Except for hope.
Go. Yeah. How do you address that need for hope and imagination in the book, Awakening the Soul? What's the premise?
Well, so I started the book with a piece of papyrus, writing on papyrus from 4,500 years ago, in which an Egyptian scribe is lamenting his culture's collapse and how people have become violent and people blame each other for everything and how greed has dominated everything. And he feels like ending his own life because the culture has collapsed. And so one idea there is that this has kind of happened before. Maybe it's been happening to some degree all along in some version of that. What happens to him, he's called the World Weary Man. That's his title. They gave him some time when they found the scroll. And what happens to him is his soul talks back to him. So this is ancient Egypt, and they had a thing called the Ba soul, B-A, Ba soul, which would be like what I call the genius soul, the unique soul of a person. So his soul speaks to him and says, don't end your life. Go back to the origin of your life and tap into your inner potentials, and then you and I will live together until it's really time to go to the other world. So I start with that, and I say, here's, when you read this, it sounds like, you know, a report on the radio right now.
It does.
The lament.
I read it. Yeah, yeah.
And word for word, it sounds like what we're going through. Mm-hmm. And so then I try to make the distinction that he had a soul that spoke to him. Most modern people don't even know they have a soul, much less know that the soul knows more than the person does about what their life is aimed at, what their life is for. And so then I go from there to the idea that we've lost culturally, we've lost the soul. And I'm describing the soul as the connective tissue of life, the unifying force of community, and the even the coherent force within one's own life, that we've lost soul at so many levels. And it's only when people lose soul that they can consider their opposition to be evil or the enemy. That within a culture, within a community, when that starts to happen, it means that they've lost soul. Soul has been lost.
How or what kind of response do you get from people who are essentially cynics in this culture, who don't believe in such a thing as soul? How do you reach them with this notion of reconnecting to the soul?
Well, the cynic has almost by definition lost a sense of soul, and they've lost any sense of hope. That's part of what makes a person cynical. So it kind of means that a person had hope and then they felt betrayed and they lost it. That's what made them cynical. And I'm trying to say there's a deeper sense of hope that goes deeper than the cynicism. It goes deeper than the fear that it's all going to come to an end or a person's going to wind up isolated. There's something deep down, a resource inside the individual and inside the cultural group that's trying to awaken, and it tends to awaken when it's in trouble. So this is an interesting about the soul. The soul awakens more readily when it's under pressure than it does when everybody's comfortable.
Would it be fair to say that inside every cynic, there's an idealist that's been hurt?
Oh, yeah. That's been betrayed.
That's been betrayed.
That's the key issue. It's a feeling of betrayal of the ideal. The word cynic comes from the old Greek kine, which means something like a dog that keeps biting on a bone that has no marrow.
Oh, wow.
That's the kind of origin.
How do you pull that out of your head?
Oh, well, no. Well, that's what
amazing.
I study. I study words and stories and ideas like that.
So it sounds as though what you're saying is that within all of us, there is a soul yearning to be awakened.
Oh, yeah. And the soul has these deep resources that a person only finds when they're in trouble. It takes pressure and trouble to awaken the deeper nature of a person.
How do we do that? How do we reconnect with soul?
Well, it requires a kind of trust in oneself. And it's harder to trust oneself now because the whole environment is just rank with betrayal and distortion and false ideas and false everything. But in a way, I think the only solution is to turn to oneself. And so that's what creates the problem. Can I trust myself? And it's not the little self that makes believe it's in charge, because
we're not.
That's not too helpful in the long run. But the deeper self, which is called the deep soul or the deep self, that actually knows what our life is about and what our life is aimed at. In the end of the book, and I had no idea where things were going when I was writing the book in terms of the Kavanaugh hearing and stuff like that, or what's happening currently, but I ended the book by writing about living in truth, that the soul is the source of true things, genuine imagination, but also those things that we know are true because we have lived them. And so I think the pressure of the current world can awaken the deep truth that people carry inside. And in a way, a person has to trust that if they have lived through some danger, that a part of them knows how to live through danger. And that's the part I call living in truth, the deeper truth of who we are. Another idea, when things are really difficult, there's an acceleration of calling. If people are listening, like the world-weary man, if he's listening to the boss soul, it's telling him to go deeper, find those resources, and live with meaning. So we, in other words, we can't wait for people to reimagine meaning and culture and deliver it to us. We have to find what's meaningful in our lives and live the truth of that. And that lived truth, when enough people are doing it, creates a movement in the culture. I don't think it's a simple movement. We all have to agree on the same political idea. We should figure out how to vote, and vote soon, and vote often, as they used to say. But
in Chicago.
Yeah. Right. But the bigger vote is voting with one's life, voting for the meaning carried inside the individual soul. And it's going to take a lot of people to do that in order to change things.
It sounds like a huge undertaking. And the first thought that comes to my mind is that there are so many voices out there telling us not to listen to our inner selves. How do we dig through that to get down to listening to what our souls are saying to us?
Well, in the depth of the soul, besides this amazing capacity for imagination, and the job now is not doing minor repair, it's reimagining culture and nature. Remember, we're in a strange condition of living during the rattling of nature as well as the unraveling of culture, very unusual historically. So we have to reimagine how to help nature and how to conjoin culture back with nature so culture isn't destroying nature. That's a job of ours. The biggest crisis in the world right now is the environmental crisis. Next comes the humanitarian crisis. This is all how I write about it in the book. And the humanitarian crisis is all of the oppressions and all of the distortions that are in politics worldwide now. But the third crisis is the crisis of truth and meaning. And it seems to me, if we don't solve the issues of truth and meaning, we can't solve the humanitarian issues, and we can't help solve the environmental issues. So the core for human beings is we carry truth and meaning in our bodies and in our souls. And we are called repeatedly in life to live a meaningful life, except that people tend to not hear that call anymore. There's a lot of distraction. There's a lot of distortion. And somehow a person has to remember what is really meaningful to them in the depth of the soul, the way I imagine it. Besides this deep capacity to reimagine things, there's also love. And one of the key, easiest ways to find the depth of the soul is, what does a person love? Who does a person love? How does a person love? That's all true to the soul.
What is the truth of love? And when I hear you talk, I start thinking about how ugly and contentious the whole atmosphere of the world has become, as if, on the one hand, truth is beginning to emerge, and on the other hand, the reaction to that is violent, because the potential for truth perhaps is gaining strength. Are you seeing anything like that?
Well, what I see is that, again, mythology is how I start with things.
Right.
And so if someone said, what myth are we living in now? the Greek term for it was apocalypsis, not apocalypse, the fiery end with zombies, but apocalypsis means collapse renewal. This was their idea that the world sometimes falls apart at the level of nature and at the level of culture, but at the same time, there is a renewal happening that happens just the way a forest renews with little seedlings that are growing. Those seedlings are the seedlings of imagination growing from individual souls. And so there's many things that are trying to come into the world, and that would include maybe a more clear-eyed view of just how damaging oppressive cultures are and dominant political systems that really are not going to work for what's trying to happen in the world. And so we have to witness the collapse. I think that's evident. But we also have to find these roots of renewal that are our human inheritance at the level of the soul. And so an interesting thing that happens is when there's a lot of trouble and when there's chaos, there's a an increase in calling. The loosening of the system, the rattling of things, allows the voice of calling to get in and say, well, wait a minute, my life really... what I love is plants and trees, and that's what I want to live for and live with. And there's plenty of work to do in the area of improving environmental systems and rebuilding ecosystems. And there's a lot of people working at that. And there's other people that are naturally called to work in culture, to do healing, to feed the hungry, to figure out how to deal and help the procession of poor people trying to find a way out of destitution and leaving Central America rather than pretending that they're invaders, but see them as fellow human beings suffering what we're all suffering in some way, except in a more intense way for them. And there are people that can figure out how to deal with that better than simply pretending they're invaders and sending the military after them.
And perhaps the extreme that is the military, that is... labeling these people and doing so many other horrific things in the world. Maybe that is activating the souls of those folks who might be able to take action. You're listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with Michael Mead, the only paid mythologist I know around, and we can do this thanks to the generosity of Windermere Vashon Real Estate, who supports all our community information programming, and they make our emergency alert service possible. Michael, we're talking about awakening the soul and doing that perhaps as an answer to the horrific condition of the world right now. What can myth tell us, for instance, about how to work with nature, how to rekindle the vitality in nature that we have begun to destroy?
So first thing is, so I wrote a book called Why the World Doesn't End.
I remember that book.
And the idea was there are cultural stories throughout the world about how the world renews itself from its own ashes or its own remnants. So that's the first idea, is that the world itself, there's a world soul also, and it has a capacity to renew. And so that's, then humans have that capacity also. Most people have lived through very difficult things, illnesses, losses and stuff, and then they rebuild their life. That's in us if we trust that, if we, especially if we're moving in a direction that is attuned to our own soul, we have a greater capacity to renew. So myth talks about that both in on the human side and on the nature side of things. So I don't think that's the issue. That's why I wrote Why the World Doesn't End. It's not going to end. Mythologically, it can't even end. That's another story in that book. But then the next thing I wrote about was the genius myth.
Yes.
And this is the idea that everybody is born with the seed of genius in the soul, like the world-weary man has that genius saying to him, don't let your life, don't give up on your life, go back to your origins. And the origin story of each person includes the birth of a genius. And genius doesn't mean high IQ or a certain specific talent. What genius, the meaning of it is the spirit that's already there. So a person is born with a particular spirit for life that they forget when they're born. They're a baby, then they have to be raised by a family. They grow up in a community. Good things happen, bad things happen, whatever the story becomes. But that seed of genius is still there. And that genius is what the calling calls to. The calling calls to a spirit that was in our life to begin with. And life becomes more satisfying, more fulfillable, and we get more courage if we're walking the road that our own genius calls us to be on. And I think when things get as troublesome as they are now, that's what should happen. More people should respond to that calling. In the book, there's a chapter on the two adventures of life. And the first adventure is just to get a life, as we say. You know,
get a life. Yeah.
Get some jobs, get fired, whatever. Some life and see what it feels like. The second adventure is the awakening of the soul and living the adventure that the soul came to live. And so strangely enough, when things get more difficult, the soul's adventure becomes more possible. If you begin to realize how dangerous it has become, how many things can go wrong, it's almost like, why not live the path of meaning if things are going to be difficult anyway? And so I think there's an acceleration of calling that calls people to awaken to their soul, which includes their genius path, let's say. Mm-hmm. It includes access to deep imagination, includes empathy and sympathy and all the things that are missing in the current administration, but also now missing throughout the world.
I guess we do have leadership in a negative way. And as I listen to you, I'm wondering, in your exploration of mythology and current events and how you weave those two together, it sounds to me like there's been a continuum from your first book, or from at least from Why the World Didn't End to the genius myth to awakening the soul.
Yeah.
Has there been a continuum
of discovery like, for you? A trilogy.
Yes, right.
Yeah. And the idea of the genius myth, for me, mythologically, is different from the hero's myth. I like the hero stories. It's great. Mm-hmm. They're a little bit masculine. They're a little bit aimed at the outer world. They're a little bit achievement oriented. They lend themselves too easily to violent video games and so on.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Genius is something everyone has by nature of being born. Girl, boy, trans, in between, inventing genders, whatever. We're in that time where things are loosened and therefore there's many diversities that are, you know, become more known. And genius is the deepest kind of diversity you can find in human culture.
And so we come to Awakening the Soul, and the blurb, if you will, for your book says that you use examples from your own life to illustrate how the soul awakens. Would you be willing to tell a story or two about that?
Well, that's the harder part for me.
I'm sure.
But there are times when you have to speak about your own life in order to be genuine, but also in order to demonstrate that what you're pronouncing comes from somewhere meaningful. So one of the stories is how, which I've written about before, but I wrote about it differently this time, how during the 60s when I got drafted for the Vietnam War, I decided it wasn't a legal war. And it wasn't a just war, and I wasn't going to go. And I was offered two opportunities, go into the military or go to prison for various reasons I explain in the book. I went into the military, found out I was not good at that. I wouldn't follow orders that went against my soul. And that led to me being put in prison. I wasn't a good prisoner. That led to me going to solitary confinement. And it was there that I actually found myself and found out things about myself and about my own soul. And I found a depth that had to do with justice on one hand, but it had to do with ancestral kind of knowledge. My Irish ancestors kind of helped me out when I was in solitary. And I found out that mythic imagination was a core aspect of my life. I was months in solitary, but I wasn't alone because I actually had stories and the characters from stories. You know, there was a few days where I was thinking, am I losing my mind or am I finding my mind? And I decided to vote for finding my mind. And I've been living with mythology ever since then.
Takes a really strong mind to, how many months were you in solitary?
Five.
Oh my God. Did you have books to read?
I had no books. They took away all writing materials. It was genuine solitary.
Wow.
Yeah.
How does each of us get to our solitary confinement in order to awaken our souls?
So I think, mythologically, what happens is the story leads us into a descent. That was a descent for me, from walking around in the regular world to descending until I was in a dungeon, essentially.
Yeah.
And everybody has their descents. And I think one of the false hopes is we're told life shouldn't be that way. But life goes up and it goes down. And the descent is often the greater source of knowledge and learning and finding those roots and resources that we carry inside that we can actually trust and build our life from. And so I think people find it by allowing this descent or revisiting the descent. In the book, I talk about going back into indelible experiences in one's life, which are often dark or troublesome, and then examining them to find out what capacity in us got us through those troubles and what can we still learn from having survived some trouble. So when you see the culture in a big descent, a serious descent right now into chaos, into increasing violence, into oppression, into all kinds of real distortion and brutality, in that descent, we have to find the underlying soul, the underlying meaning, and the underlying diversity of America, which is really one of the deepest aspects of America, has to become revitalized. And the same thing for the individual. Take those descents where we lost a loved one, or we lost a career, or whatever it was. It was in that descent that we actually found parts of ourselves that could rebuild and renew our lives.
It sounds as though you're talking about both a communal soul and an individual soul.
I think once the soul awakens, what awakens with it is, how do I serve?
Ah.
And in the end of the book, part of Living in Truth, I talk about Dharma, which is the old Sanskrit word for serving something greater than oneself. What we have going on now, from one way you could look at it, in terms of a mythological interpretation, we, like other places in the world, have leaders who are only about themselves, only about getting what they want, whether it's something for them to keep or something for them to use, politically and so on. And it's the opposite of serving the community. It's the opposite of having a meaning in life. And so it tells us that the antidote has to be finding the service, the meaning, the way of having a bigger life inside ourselves.
And I wonder, as I hear you speak, there seems to me to be an increase in depression, at least in this country. And some folks say the antidote to depression is action. If one does as you're suggesting and goes deep into those indelible experiences, that can cause depression. What do we do? How do we use that depression? I'm not even saying get out of it, but use it to awaken the soul, both individually and in a communal perspective.
So there's a chapter on descent and trusting in the soul, because I'm aware of that, and dealing with all kinds of communities and lots of young people, you encounter really three things nowadays: fear, anxiety, and depression. And anxiety is now at the top.
Yeah.
And the problem is what's called collective anxiety. When everything gets so rattled, it's normal to have anxiety if you have a big test tomorrow. If you have no test and you're anxious, that's collective anxiety.
Ah.
And so it's hard to explain simply, but I went back to the old idea of Hamlet, to be or not to be, which has elements of it, fear, anxiety, and depression. And I decided that's not the right question. It's not to be or not to be. It's to be my genuine self or not to be.
Michael Mead, we are unfortunately out of time. I am so grateful for your being here. You will be hosting a presentation next Thursday, November 8th.
2 days after the election.
2 days after election. Good timing. Here on Vashon Island at the Methodist Church.
Yeah, 7 o'clock at the Methodist
7
Church.
7 p.m.
And I think it's titled Truth and the Living Soul.
Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for all that you do. And thank you for listening to Real Talk. We're here every Tuesday at lunchtime. My name is Susan McCabe, and I'm grateful to our theme composer. He's Luke McQuillan. Thanks for listening.